And good afternoon, it's Rod McClure here with our Monday afternoon book reading. And I'm going to actually go with another Lovecraft story because the book that I intended to read was unfortunately damaged. So nice wet weather we had, wasn't it? That'll tide us over until I can come up with something for the new year. But before we go any further, a word from our sponsors.
Braidwood Butchery, high quality meats and old fashioned friendly service. And they also smoke all their own deli range on the premises and are open 5.5 days a week. Braidwood Butchery, 137 Wallace Street, Braidwood, 4842 2472. A proud sponsor of Braidwood FM.
Braidwood Veterinary Surgery has been providing high-quality veterinary services to Braidwood and the surrounds since 1989. Their veterinarians have extensive knowledge of preventative and diagnostic health of all species, no matter how large or small. They're open Monday to Friday, 9 till 5, and Saturdays, 9 till noon. You can call them on 48 42 2697, a proud sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
Holdfast Distillery is Braidwood's first distillery, located in the basement of Braidwood Hotel at 180 Wallace Street. Their products are made with Australian grain and are distilled in their specially designed still to produce clean and crisp products. They select the best botanicals grown in Australia or sourced from overseas, ensuring there is no compromise in their products. Call 0406 083 963 for opening hours. Holdfast Distillery, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And a big thank you to our sponsors, as always. And the Lovecraft story is a thing called Mountains of Madness. What makes it interesting is he had this fascination with modern inventions, modern things, and seems to have really enjoyed it. He was also interested in places that had been barely explored. Anyway, away we go. At the Mountains of Madness. I'm forced into speech because men of science have refused to follow my advice without knowing why. It is altogether against my will that I tell my reasons for opposing this contemplated invasion of the Antarctic, with its vast fossil cap and its wholesale boring and melting of the ancient ice cap. And I am the more reluctant because my warnings may be in vain. Doubt of the real facts, as I must reveal them, is inevitable. Yet if I suppressed what will seem extravagant and incredible, there would be nothing left. The hitherto withheld photographs, both ordinary and aerial, will count in my favour, for they are damnably vivid and graphic. Still, they will be doubted because of the great lengths to which clever fakery can be carried. The ink drawings, of course, will be jeered at as obvious impostures, notwithstanding a strangeness of technique which art experts ought to remark and puzzle over. In the end, I must rely on the judgment and standing of the few scientific leaders who have, on the one hand, sufficient independence of thought to weigh my data on its own hideously convincing merits, or in the light of certain primordial and highly baffling myth cycles, and on the other hand, sufficient influence to deter the exploring world in general from any rash and overambitious program in the region of those mountains of madness. It is an unfortunate fact that relatively obscure men like myself and my associates, connected only with a small university, have little chance of making an impression where matters of wildly bizarre or highly controversial nature are concerned. It is further against us that we are not, in the strictest sense, specialists in the fields which came primarily to be concerned. As a geologist, my object in leading the Miskatonic University expedition was wholly that of securing deep-level specimens of rock and soil from various parts of the Antarctic continent, aided by the remarkable drill devised by Professor Frank H. Parbody of our engineering department. I had no wish to be a pioneer in any other field than this, but I did hope that the use of this new mechanical appliance at various different points along previously explored paths would bring to light materials of a sort hitherto unreached by the ordinary methods of collection. Parbody's drilling apparatus, as the public already knows from our reports, was unique and radical in its lightness, portability, and capacity to combine the ordinary artesian drill principle with the principle of a small, circular rock drill in such a way as to cope quickly with strata of varying hardness, steelhead, jointed rods, gasoline motor, collapsible wooden derrick, dynamiting paraphernalia, cording, rubbish removal, auger, and sectional piping for bores 5 inches wide and up to 1,000 feet deep, all formed with needed accessories no greater load than the 3 7-dog sledges could carry. This being made possible by the clever aluminium alloy of which most of the metal objects were fashioned. 4 huge Dornier aeroplanes, designed especially for the tremendous altitude flying necessary on the Antarctic plateau, and with added fuel warming and quick-starting devices worked out by Parbody, would transport our entire expedition from a base at the edge of the Great Ice Barrier to various suitable inland points, and from these points a sufficient quota of dogs would serve us. We planned to cover as great an area as one Antarctic season, or longer if absolutely necessary, would permit, operating mostly in the mountain ranges and on the plateau south of Ross Sea, regions explored in varying degree by Shackleton, Amundsen, Scott and Bird, with frequent changes of camp made by aeroplane and involving distances great enough to be of geological significance, we expected to unearth a quite unprecedented amount of material, especially in the Precambrian strata, of which so narrow a range of Antarctic specimens had previously been secured. We wished also to obtain as great as possible a variety of the upper fossiliferous rocks, since the primal life history of this bleak realm of ice and death is of the highest importance to our knowledge of the Earth's past. That the Antarctic continent was once temperate and even tropical, with a teeming vegetable and animal life, of which the lichens, marine fauna, arachnida, and penguins of the northern edge are the only survivals, is a matter of common information, and we hope to expand that information in a variety, accuracy, and detail. When a simple boring revealed fossiliferous signs, we would enlarge the aperture by blasting in order to get specimens of suitable size and condition. Our borings of varying depth, according to the promise held out by the upper soil or rock, were to be confined to exposed or nearly exposed land surfaces, these inevitably being slopes and ridges because of the 1 or 2 mile thickness of solid ice overlaying the lower levels. We could not afford to waste drilling depth on any considerable amount of mere glaciation, though Parbody had worked out a plan for seeking copper electrodes in thick clusters of borings and melting off limited areas of ice with current from a gasoline-driven dynamo. It is this plan, which we could not put into effect except experimentally on an expedition such as ours, that the coming Starkweather Moore expedition proposes to follow, despite warnings I have issued since our return from the Antarctic. The public knows of the Miskatonic expedition through our frequent wireless reports to the Arkham Advertiser and Associated Press, and through the latter articles of Parbody and myself. We consisted of 4 men from the university, Parbody, Lake of the Biology Department, Atwood of the Physics Department, also a meteorologist, and I representing geology and having nominal command, besides 16 assistants, 7 graduate students from Miskatonic and 9 skilled mechanics. Of these 16, 12 were qualified aeroplane pilots. All but 2 of them were competent wireless operators. 8 of them understood navigation with compass and sextant, as did Parbody, Atwood and I. In addition, of course, our 2 ships, wooden ex-whalers, reinforced for ice conditions and having auxiliary steam, were fully manned. The Nathaniel Derby Pickman Foundation, aided by a few special contributions, financed the expedition. Hence, our preparations were extremely thorough, despite the absence of great publicity. The dogs, sledges, machines, camp materials and unassembled parts of our 5 planes were delivered in Boston, and there our ships were loaded. We were marvellously well equipped for our specific purpose, and in all matters pertaining to supplies, regimen, transportation, and camp construction, we profited by the excellent example of our many recent and exceptionally brilliant predecessors. It was the unusual number and fame of these predecessors which made our own expedition, ample though it was, so little noticed by the world at large. As the newspapers told, we sailed from Boston Harbour on September 2, 1930, taking a leisurely course down the coast and through the Panama Canal, and stopping at Samoa and Hobart, Tasmania, at which latter place we took on final supplies. None of our exploring party had ever been in the polar regions before, hence we all relied greatly on our ship captains, J.B. Douglas commanding the brig Arkham and serving as commander of the Sea Party, and George Thorfinnsson commanding the bark Miskatonic, both veteran whalers in Antarctic waters. As we left the inhabited world behind, the sun sank lower and lower in the north and stayed longer and longer above the horizon each day. At about 62 degrees south latitude, we sighted our first icebergs, table-like objects with vertical sides, and just before reaching the Antarctic Circle, which we crossed on October 20th with appropriately quaint ceremonies, we were considerably troubled with field ice. The falling temperature bothered me considerably after our long voyage through the tropics, but I tried to brace up for the worst rigours to come. On many occasions, the curious atmospheric effects enchanted me vastly. These included strikingly vivid mirage, the first I had ever seen, in which distant bergs became the battlements of unimaginable cosmic castles. Pushing through the ice, which was fortunately neither extensive nor thickly packed, we regained open water at south latitude 67 degrees, east longitude 175 degrees. On the morning of October 26th, a strong land blink appeared on the south, and before noon we all felt a thrill of excitement at beholding a vast, lofty, and snow-clad mountain chain, which opened out and covered the whole vista ahead. At last we had encountered an outpost of the great unknown continent and its cryptic world of frozen death. These peaks were obviously the Admiralty Range, discovered by Ross, and it would now be our task to round Cape Adare and sail down the east coast of Victoria Land to our contemplated base on the shore of McMurdo Sound, at the foot of the volcano Erebus, in south latitude 77 degrees 9 minutes. The last lap of the voyage was vivid and fancy-stirring. Great barren peaks of mystery looming up constantly against the west as the low northern sun of noon or the still lower horizon grazing southern sun of midnight poured its hazy reddish rays over the white snow. Bluish ice and water lanes and black bits of exposed granite slope. Through the desolate summit swept raging intermittent gusts of the terrible Antarctic wind, whose cadences sometimes held vague suggestions of a wild and half-sentient musical piping, with notes extending over a wide range, and which for subconscious, mnemonic reason seemed to me disquieting and even dimly terrible. Something about the scene reminded me of the strange and disturbing Asian paintings of Nicholas Roerich, and of the still stranger and more disturbing descriptions of the evilly fabled Plateau of Leng, which occurred in the dreaded Necronomicon of the mad Arab Abdul al-Harazid. I was rather sorry later on that I had ever looked into that monstrous book at the college library. On the 7th of November, sight of the westward range, having been temporarily lost, we passed Franklin Island, and on the next day descried the cones of Mounts Erebus and Terror on Ross Island ahead, with the long line of the Parry Mountains beyond. There now stretched off to the east the low white line of the Great Ice Barrier, rising perpendicularly to a height of 200 feet, like the rocky cliffs of Quebec, and marking the end of southward navigation. In the afternoon we entered McMurdo Sound and stood off the coast in the lee of smoking Mount Erebus. The Scoriac Peak towered up some 12,700 feet against the eastern sky, like a Japanese print of the sacred Fujiyama, while beyond it rose the white, ghost-like height of Mount Terror, 10,900 feet in altitude, and now extinct as a volcano. Puffs of smoke from Erebus became intermittently, and one of the graduate assistants, a brilliant young fellow named Danforth, pointed out what looked like lava on the snowy slope, remarking that this mountain, discovered in 1840, had undoubtedly been the source of Poe's image when he wrote 7 years later of, quote, "the lavas that restlessly roll their sulphurous currents down Yaanek in the ultimate climbs of the pole, the groan as they roll down Mount Yaanek in the realms of the boreal pole." Danforth was a great reader of bizarre material and had talked a good deal of Poe. I was interested myself because of the Antarctic scene of Poe's only long story, the disturbing and enigmatical Arthur Gordon Pym. On the barren shore and on the lofty ice barrier in the background, myriads of grotesque penguins squawked and flapped their fins, while many fat seals were visible on the water, swimming or sprawling across large cakes of slowly drifting ice. Using small boats, we effected a difficult landing on Ross Island shortly after midnight, on the morning of the 9th, carrying a line of cable from each of the ships and preparing to unload supplies by means of breeches buoy arrangement. Our sensations on first treading Antarctic soil were poignant and complex, even though at this particular point the Scott and Shackleton expeditions had preceded us. Our camp on the frozen shore below the volcano's slope was only a provisional one, headquarters being kept aboard the Arkham. We landed all our drilling apparatus, dogs, sledges, tents, provisions, gasoline tanks, experimental ice melting outfit, cameras, both ordinary and aerial, aeroplane parts and other accessories, including three small portable wireless outfits, besides those in the planes, capable of communicating with the Arkham's large outfit from any part of the Antarctic continent that we would be likely to visit. The ship's outfit, communicating with the outside world, was to convey press reports to the Arkham Advertiser's powerful wireless station in Kingsport Head, Massachusetts. We hoped to complete our work during a single Antarctic summer, but if this proved impossible, we'd winter on the Arkham, sending the Miskatonic north before the freezing of the ice for another summer's supplies. I need not repeat what the newspapers have already published about our early work, our ascent of Mount Erebus, our successful mineral borings at several points on Ross Island, and the singular speed with which Parbody's apparatus accomplished them, even through solid rock layers, our provisional test of the small ice-melting equipment, our perilous ascent of the Great Barrier with sledges and supplies, and our final assembling of five huge aeroplanes at the camp atop the barrier. The health of our land party, 20 men and 55 Alaskan sledge dogs, was remarkable, though of course we had so far encountered no really destructive temperatures or windstorms. For the most part, the thermometer varied between 0 and 20 or 25 degrees above, and our experience with New England winters had accustomed us to rigours of this sort. The barrier camp was semi-permanent and destined to be a storage cache for gasoline, provisions, dynamite and other supplies. Only four of our planes were needed to carry the actual exploring material, the fifth being left with a pilot and two men from the ships at the storage cache to form a means of reaching us from the Arkham in case all our exploring planes were lost. Later, when not using all the other planes for moving apparatus, we would employ one or two in a shuttle transportation service between this cache and another permanent base on the Great Plateau from 600 to 700 miles southward, beyond Beardmore Glacier. Despite the almost unanimous accounts of appalling winds and tempests that pour down from the plateau, we determined to dispense with the intermediate bases, taking our chances in the interests of economy and probable efficiency. Wireless reports have spoken of the breathtaking four-hour non-stop flight of our squadron on November 21st over the lofty shelf ice, with vast peaks rising on the west and the unfathomed silences echoing to the sound of our engines. Wind troubled us only moderately, and our radio compass helped us through the one opaque fog we encountered. When the vast rise loomed ahead between latitudes 83 degrees and 84 degrees, we knew we had reached Beardmore Glacier, the largest valley glacier in the world, and that the frozen sea was now giving place to a frowning and mountainous coastline. At last, we were truly entering the white, eon-dead world of the ultimate south, and even as we realised it, we saw the peak of Mount Nansen in the eastern distance towering up to its height of almost 15,000 feet. The successful establishment of the southern base above the glacier in latitude 86 degrees 7 minutes east longitude 174 degrees 23 minutes and the phenomenally rapid and effective borings and blastings made at various points reached by our sledge trips and short aeroplane flights are matters of history, as is the arduous and triumphant ascent of Mount Nansen by Parbody and two of the graduate students, Gedney and Carroll, on December 13th to 15th. We were some 8,500 feet above sea level, and when experimental drillings revealed solid ground only 12 feet down through the snow and ice at certain points, we made considerable use of the small melting apparatus and sunk bores and performed dynamiting at many places where no previous explorer had ever thought of securing mineral specimens. The Precambrian granites and Beacon sandstones thus obtained confirmed our belief that this plateau was homogeneous with the great bulk of the continent to the west, but somewhat different from the parts lying eastward below South America, which we then thought to form a separate and smaller continent, divided from the larger one by a frozen junction of the Ross and Weddell Seas, though Bird has since disproved this hypothesis. In certain of the sandstones, dynamited and chiselled after boring, revealed their nature, we found some highly interesting fossil markings and fragments, notably ferns, seaweeds, trilobites, crinoids, and such mollusks as lingulae and gastropods, all of which seemed of real significance in connection with the region's primordial history. There was also a queer, triangular, striated marking, about a foot in greatest diameter, which Lake pieced together from three fragments of slate brought up from a deep blasted aperture. These fragments came from a point to the westward, near the Queen Alexandra Range, and Lake, as a biologist, seemed to find their curious markings unusually puzzling and provocative, though to my geological eye it looked not unlike some of the ripple effects reasonably common in the sedimentary rocks. Since slate is no more than a metamorphic formation into which a sedimentary stratum is pressed, and since the pressure itself produces odd distorting effects on any markings which may exist, I saw no reason for extreme wonder over the striated depressions. On January the 6th, 1931, Lake, Parbody, Danforth, all six of the students, four mechanics and I, flew directly over the South Pole in two of the Great Plains, being forced down once by a sudden high wind, which fortunately did not develop into a typical storm. This was, as the papers have stated, one of several observation flights, during others of which we tried to discern new topographical features in areas unreached by previous explorers. Our early flights were disappointing in this manner, in this latter respect, though they afforded us some magnificent examples of the richly fantastic and deceptive mirages of the polar regions, of which our sea voyage had given us some brief foretastes. Distant mountains floated in the sky as enchanted cities, and often the whole white world would dissolve into a gold, silver and scarlet land of Dunsanian dreams and adventurous expectancy under magic of the low midnight sun. On cloudy days, we had considerable trouble in flying, owing to the tendency of snowy earth and sky to merge into one mystical opalescent void, with no visible horizon to mark the junction of the two. At length we resolved to carry out our original plan of flying 500 miles eastward, with all four exploring planes, and establishing a fresh sub-base at a point which would probably be on the smaller continental division, as we mistakenly conceived it. Geological specimens obtained there would be desirable for purposes of comparison. Our health so far had remained excellent, lime juice well offsetting the steady diet of tinned and salted food, and temperatures generally above zero, enabling us to do without our thickest furs. It was now midsummer, and with haste and care we might be able to conclude the work by March and avoid a tedious wintering through the long Antarctic night. Several savage windstorms had burst upon us from the west, but we had escaped damage through the skill of Atwood in devising rudimentary aeroplane shelters and windbreaks of heavy snow blocks and reinforcing the principal camp buildings with snow. Our good luck and efficiency had indeed been almost uncanny. The outside world knew, of course, of our program and was told also of Lake's strange and dogged insistence on a westward, or rather northwestward, prospecting trip before our radical shift to the new base. It seems he had pondered a great deal, and with alarmingly radical daring, over that triangular striated marking in the slate, reading into it certain contradictions in nature and geological period which whetted his curiosity to the utmost, and made him avid to sink more borings and blastings in the west-stretching formation to which the exhumed fragments evidently belonged. He was strangely convinced that the markings was the print of some bulky, unknown and radically unclassifiable organism of considerably advanced evolution, notwithstanding that the rock which bore it was of so vastly ancient a date, Cambrian if not actually Precambrian, as to preclude the probable existence not only of all highly evolved life, but of any life at all above the unicellular, or at most, the trilobite stage. These fragments with their odd markings must have been 500 million to 1,000 million years old. Chapter 2. Popular imagination, I judge, responded actively to our wireless bulletins of lakes start northwestward into regions never trodden by human foot or penetrated by human imagination. Though we did not mention his wild hopes of revolutionising the entire sciences of biology and geology. His preliminary sledging and boring journey of January 11th to 18th, with Parbody and five others, marred by the loss of two dogs in an upset when crossing one of the great pressure ridges in the ice, had brought up more and more of the Archaean slate, and even I was interested by the singular profusion of evident fossil markings in that unbelievably ancient stratum. These markings, however, were of very primitive life forms, involving no great paradox except that any life forms should occur in rock as definitely Precambrian as this seemed to be. Hence, I still failed to see the good sense of Lake's demand for an interlude in our time-saving program, an interlude requiring the use of all four planes, many men, and the whole of the expedition's mechanical apparatus. I did not, in the end, veto the plan, though I decided not to accompany the northwestward party, despite Lake's plea for my geological advice. While they were gone, I would remain at the base with Parbody and five men and work out final plans for the eastward shift. In preparation for this transfer, one of the planes had begun to move up a good gasoline supply from McMurdo Sound, but this could wait temporarily. I kept with me one sledge and nine dogs, since it is unwise to be at any time without possible transportation in an utterly tenantless world of aeon-long death. Lake's sub-expedition into the unknown, as everyone will recall, sent out its own reports from the shortwave transmitters on the plains, these being simultaneously picked up by our apparatus at the southern base and by the Arkham at McMurdo Sound, whence they were relayed to the outside world on wavelengths of up to 50 metres. The start was made January 22nd at 4 a.m, and the first wireless message we received came only 2 hours later, when Lake spoke of descending and starting a small-scale ice melting and bore at some point 300 miles away from us. 6 hours after that, a second and very excited message told of the frantic beaver-like work whereby a shallow shaft had been sunk and blasted, culminating in the discovery of slate fragments with several markings approximately like the one which had caused the original puzzlement. 3 hours later, a brief bulletin announced the resumption of the flight in the teeth of a roar and piercing gale, and when I dispatched a message of protest against further hazards, Lake replied curtly that his new specimens made any hazard worth taking. I saw that his excitement had reached the point of mutiny, and that I could do nothing to check this headlong risk of the whole expedition's success. But it was appalling to think of his plunging deeper and deeper into that treacherous and sinister wide immensity of tempests and unfathomed mysteries which stretched off for some 1,500 miles to the half-known, half-suspected coastline of Queen Mary and Knox Lands. Then in about an hour and a half more came that doubly excited message from Lake's moving plane, which almost reversed my sentiments and made me wish I had accompanied the party. The message read, 10:05 p.m. on the wing. After snowstorm have spied mountain range ahead higher than any hitherto seen. May equal Himalayas, allowing for height of plateau. Probable latitude 76 degrees 15 minutes, longitude 113 degrees 10 minutes east. Reach as far as one can see right and left. Suspicion of two smoking cones, all peaks black and bare of snow. Gale blowing off them impedes navigation. Unquote. After that, Parbody, the men and I hung breathlessly over the receiver. Thought of this titanic mountain rampart, 700 miles away, inflamed our deepest sense of adventure, and we rejoiced that our expedition, if not ourselves personally, had been its discoverers. In half an hour, Lake called us again. Quote, Moulton's plane forced down on plateau in foothills. Nobody hurt and perhaps can repair. shall transfer essentials to other three for return or further moves if necessary. But no more heavy plane travel needed just now. Mountains surpass anything in imagination. I am going up scouting in Carol's plane with all weight out. You can't imagine anything like this. Highest peaks must be over 35,000 feet. Everest out of the running. Atwood to work out height with the theodolite while Carol and I go up. Probably wrong about cones, for formations look stratified. Possibly Precambrian slate with other strata mixed in. Queer skyline effects, regular sections of cubes clinging to the highest peaks. Whole thing marvellous in red-gold light of low sun. Like land of mystery in a dream, or gateway to forbidden world of untrodden wonder. Wish you were here to study. End of message. Though it was technically sleeping time, not one of us listeners thought for a moment of retiring. It must have been a good deal the same at McMurdo Sound, where the supply cache and the Arkham were also getting the messages, for Captain Douglas gave out a call congratulating everybody on the important find, and Sherman, the cache operator, seconded his sentiments. We were sorry, of course, about the damaged aeroplane, but hoped it could be easily mended. Then, at 11 p.m, came another call from Lake. Message began. Up with Carol over the highest foothills. Don't dare try really tall peaks in present weather, but shall later. Frightful work climbing and hard going at this altitude, but worth it. Great range, fairly solid, hence can't get any glimpses beyond. Main summits exceed Himalayas and very queer. Range looks like Precambrian slate with plain signs of many other upheaved strata. Was wrong about volcanism. Goes farther in either direction than we can see. Swept clear of snow above about 21,000 feet. Odd formations on slopes of highest mountains. Great low square blocks with exactly vertical sides and rectangular lines of low vertical ramparts like the old Asian castles clinging to steep mountains in Rorich paintings. Impressive from the distance. Few close to some. And Carol thought they formed a smaller, separate pieces, but that is probably weathering. Most edges crumbled and rounded off as if exposed to storms and climate changes for millions of years. Parts, especially upper parts, seem to be of lighter coloured rock than any visible strata on slopes proper, hence an evidently crystalline origin. Close flying shows many cave mouths, some unusually regular in outline, square or semicircular. You must come and investigate. I think I saw rampart squarely on top of one peak. Height seems like about 30,000. To 35,000 feet. Am up 21,500 myself, in devilish gnawing cold. Wind whistles and pipes through passes and in and out of caves, but no flying danger so far. End of message. From then on, for another half an hour, Lake kept up a running fire of comment and expressed his intention of climbing some of the peaks on foot. I replied that I would join him as soon as he could send a plane, and that Parbody and I would work out the best gasoline plan, just where and how to concentrate our supply, in view of the expedition's altered character. Obviously, Lake's boring operations, as well as his aeroplane activities, would need a great deal delivered for the new base, which he was to establish at the foot of the mountains, and it was possible that the eastward flight might not be made after all this season. In connection with this business, I called Captain Douglas and asked him to get as much as possible out of the ships and up to the barrier with the single dog team we had left there. A direct route across the unknown region between Lake and McMurdo Sound was what we really ought to establish. Lake called me later to say that he had decided to let the camp stay where Morton's plane had been forced down and where repairs had been already progressed somewhat. The ice sheet was very thin, with dark ground here and there visible, and he would sink some borings and blasts at that very point before making any sledge trips or climbing expeditions. He spoke of the ineffable majesty of the whole scene, and the queer state of his sensations at being in the lee of vast, silent pinnacles whose ranks shot up like a wall, reaching the sky at the world's rim. Atwood's theodolite observations had placed the height of the five smallest peaks at from 30,000 to 34,000 feet. The windswept nature of the terrain clearly disturbed Lake, for it argued the occasional existence of prodigious gales, violent beyond anything we had so far encountered. His camp lay a little more than 5 miles from where the higher foothills abruptly rose. I could almost trace a note of subconscious alarm in his words, flashed across a glacial void of 700 miles, as he urged that we all hasten with the matter and get the strange new region disposed of as soon as possible. He was about to rest now, after a continuous day's work of almost unparalleled speed, strenuousness, and results. In the morning, I had a three-cornered wireless talk with Lake and Captain Douglas at their widely separated bases, and it was agreed that one of Lake's planes would come to my base for Parbody and the five men, and myself as well as for all the fuel it could carry. The rest of the fuel question, depending on our decision about an easterly trip, could wait for a few days, since Lake had enough for immediate camp, heat and borings. Eventually, the old southern base ought to be restocked, but if we postponed the easterly trip, we would not use it till the next summer, and meanwhile, Lake must send a plane to explore a direct route between his new mountains and McMurdo Sound. Parbody and I prepared to close our base for a short or long period, as the case might be. If we wintered in the Antarctic, we would probably fly straight from Lake's base to the Arkham without returning to this spot. Some of our conical tents had already been reinforced by blocks of hard snow, and now we decided to complete the job of making a permanent Eskimo village. Owing to a very liberal tent supply, Lake had with him all that his base would need, even after our survival. I wirelessed that Parbody and I would be ready for the northwestward move after one day's work and one night's rest. Our labours, however, were not very steady after 4 p.m. For about that time, Lake began sending in the most extraordinary and excited messages. His working day had started unpropitiously, since an aeroplane survey of the nearly exposed rock surfaces showed an entire absence of those Archean and primordial strata for which he was looking, and which formed so great a part of the colossal peaks that loomed up at tantalising distances from the camp. Most of the rocks glimpsed were apparently Jurassic and Comanchean sandstones and Permian and Triassic schists, which now and then a glossy, black outcropping suggesting a hard clay and slaty coal. This rather discouraged Lake, whose plans all hinged on unearthing specimens more than 500 million years older. It was clear to him that in order to recover the Archean slate vein in which he had found the odd markings, he would have to make a long sledge trip from these foothills to the steep slopes of the gigantic mountains themselves. Well, we'll continue on with Lovecraft's Mountains of Madness next Monday. Isn't it interesting how the world still held and still holds great mysteries, and people can postulate back in that time of things that might exist, whether they did or not. Anyway, keep well, Braidwood. I hope everybody dries out. It was terribly humid and hot today. I hope everybody has a good week. Till next Monday, keep well. Oh, say.